Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, the show that takes you inside the Texas and federal appellate systems. Through conversations with judges, court staff, top trial and appellate lawyers, academics, and innovators, we provide practical insights to help you become a more effective advocate. Whether you're handling appeals or preparing for trial, you'll discover strategies to sharpen your arguments, innovate your practice, and stay ahead of the latest developments. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Judge Amy Clark Meacham. She is the district judge of the 201st District Court in Travis County. She's been on the bench since September of 2011 and has been the administrative judge in Travis County for about 5 years now. Welcome to the show, Judge.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here. Going to talk exciting court administration.
Oh, do we have things to talk about today? Our Supreme Court has been very active. Our legislature has been very active in handing down new mandates, expanding on old mandates. The ledge has enacted statutes affecting how civil practice is handled in Texas. And the Supreme Court has adopted rules that are designed to implement those statutes. And so one thing we want to maybe start with today, we're going to cover a lot of ground, I think, because there's just a lot of things to talk about. But the big news that we have not talked about on this show yet, and we're so glad you could join us to talk about this and other things, is that most recently in miscellaneous docket number 26-9019, the Supreme Court handed down amendments to largely rules of civil procedure 303E and then some amendments to the rules of judicial administration that are leveled at the central docket system that we have here in Travis County. And I believe Bexar County is the only other county in Texas that has that same system. There may be some qualification to that. Am I getting that wrong, Judge?
I think we're the only two that have formal centralized docketing systems, right? That's actually how we run all of our dockets. What we learned last year when we kicked this off is there's actually quite a bit of courts around the state that have versions of the central docket. They at least have very heavy shared dockets, right? They never officially transfer cases from one court number to another court number, but they try to use the resources they have in a particular county to hear those cases as efficiently as possible. Some of those were counties like Angelina County. We even learned that Collin County was running a version of a centralized system when it came to trying to get rid of some of their car wreck cases, like their low dollar car wreck cases, because at some point, it's constitutional, and actually it's not an aberrant. It's actually of constitutional design that judges for counties share jurisdiction, because that's just how courts kind of came about in the state. We really had to put a lot of look into this. I had never really thought deeply about it. And so I had to become an expert on how we ended up with this docket that in Travis County we're all used to, and how it works in other counties, and why it works this way and that way. So I've probably learned a lot more about it than anybody should. But it really was interesting to kind of dig in and kind of figure it out from the constitutional perspective of how we got here and why we got here. But we learned really that you're right on some level that the only two counties running like a traditional centralized system in Texas were Bexar and Travis. But versions of it in docket sharing and bench sharing is really happening by every trial judge. Not every, but most trial judges across the state.
I don't practice much in Austin and San Antonio. I have, but I think for our listeners who aren't in those counties, when you say centralized docket, can you expand a little bit more on what we're talking about?
It's basically a master calendar system. And we really have in Travis County since COVID, we've been really running a hybrid system, which I'll explain. I think that Bexar truly has a true master calendar, which is you don't really run anybody through a court. You run it through the presiding docket judge who changes on a month-to-month basis. In Travis County, we have a very hybrid system, really since COVID, almost because we had to. And each individual judge really has certain dockets that they run that are done by their court number. And then we also have a strong hub system with a court administrator that works with me as the local administrative judge to assign out cases to judges that are available. So think of it this way. Individual systems You just only ever hear pure the cases filed in your court number. But even that's not true because judges have associate judges, they have visiting judges, they have judges who sit on assignment, they have the presiding judge who hears recusals. So even that's not precisely true, but I think Tarrant is probably one of the closest ones where you have where if a case is filed in a court number in Tarrant, that judge mostly hears absolutely everything. Unless it's to a visiting judge, unless it's to an AJ, unless it's a PJ kind of recusal issue, it stays in that one court. That's the individual docketing system. On a central, a purely central master calendar system, it wouldn't matter at all where it was filed. And it would just sort of end up through the court administrator where it would go. And the idea is you don't just get caught up in the line, right? If the checker at the grocery store becomes available, you move to the line where the checker is available. That's a judge in this instance, but that's the idea behind it. And then we have a hybrid system in Travis County, which works a little bit both ways. We have a lot of cases that get set to one judge. We try to make complex settings or high conflict cases to one judge. And then we have a lot of settings that remain on a master calendar system, basically, which we call the central docket. It's really existed here. Again, I had to become a strange historical expert on this. For about 50 years, maybe even 60 years, as best we can figure.
Yeah, I was explaining to Jody before we started recording that when I came here from Dallas County back in 2003, Dallas County has an assigned docket, the regular quote unquote docket system. When I came to Travis County, it was an adjustment to get used to what the central docket was. Warren Vavra, who is retiring from his position as court administrator, would go around speaking to lawyer groups and give CLE talks focused specifically on how to practice in the central docket. And I eventually learned the basics of it, at least, and how not to commit too many faux pas in trying to get a hearing set. Announcing and all the details that came along with that. But we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the new summary judgment rule as time permits and a few other things. But since we've launched into the central docket, can you give us a sketch of how the central docket came to be since you're the person who's probably the most knowledgeable about this now? And then we'll talk about the transition to where we are now.
The government code, the Constitution basically says that judges who have the same jurisdiction can share benches as law allows. The best I can figure, and I went back to Scott McCown on a lot of this, who was a judge about 20 years ago in Travis County and was recently sitting for us as a visiting judge. And he helped me with some research. He was also a civil procedure professor at the University of Texas. So it was nice to have him to help me kind of work through it. It's really as simple as that, which is Travis County has a unique docket in many respects. It gets a ton of state-related cases and unique cases that are really just filed in Travis County where they have exclusive venue in Travis County. Comptroller cases, tax cases, all sorts of issues. And I think what Travis County was struggling with in the 60s, 70s was how do we meet those cases, which do require a lot of kind of support and they always got to get met, right? You can't tell the state, we can't hear your case today. You have to hear the state's case. There's certain things. I guess a good example is a bond validation case. There's a statutory requirement. You got to hear it in 20 days. And so they were meeting the demands of how are we going to do that, which all the state keeps passing all these laws and also still keep car wrecks and family court and really and truly what courts are about, which is access to justice and trying to hear cases of real people with real problems. How are we going to do both? And I think Travis County realized we're going to do it with a central docket and we're going to basically run it where we can always meet the demand of the state, but also keep our dockets running and keep our dockets alive and make sure people don't have to wait for their hearing, that they can set it when they are available and we can still keep moving. And it's not dependent on an individual judge. It's not dependent on an individual election. You can basically keep moving even though the personnel changes. That said, we've made a lot of modifications because as cases got more complex, and this is more aimed at the Dallas, the Fort Worth lawyers, the Houston lawyers, for the exact reason you said, Todd, because I practiced in Dallas to start with too. And there's always this concern that, well, how is this judge going to know what's going on in my case? How are they going to be up to date on the facts of the law? And that became more difficult. I'm just going to say, I started in 2011. We were already wrestling with that. So we became kind of a hybrid court in some ways then, really assigning some of this big litigation to one judge, but trying to free up the other judges to handle other cases. So if you're John Dietz and you get stuck for 3 months trying school finance, all of John Dietz's cases don't have to wait. They can still go to other judges to get those matters heard. That's a unique Travis County problem that we were able to fix with that. But we also had to build in to make the Houston lawyers and the Dallas lawyers feel better, a way for them to also request one judge on a regular complex setting. We built a whole technology system around sharing notes. And it's very expansive. And the judges on our docket make a lot of judges' notes and a lot of docket entries that allow us to kind of keep up what's going on.
Right. What I heard from the beginning was the upside was if you wanted a trial setting, you could get a trial setting. If you wanted a hearing, say you had a discovery dispute, you could get your discovery dispute heard. Then the ordinary parameters of the central docket, notwithstanding what you said about special assignments. And I know there was a process for that.
Like I said, I undercut it for Dietz. It wasn't 3 months. It was more like 6 months. I don't want him to watch this yeah. and like call me up and be like, you got that wrong.
Well, and on top of that, he managed the discovery docket for so long. Who could forget Godzilla? Anybody who ever was in front of him would remember that.
If you ever get to see his portrait, it's actually in the portrait. There's a Godzilla embedded in his judicial portrait. So you'll have to find it next time.
That's very fitting. I need to see that.
For most clients, supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime. What's at stake can be very significant. Very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds, so it's important to work with a company that knows the ins and outs of the process. If you have a client needing to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, contact Court Surety Bond Agency today.
Let's talk about the impetus for change. I do recall that we had a letter from Chief Justice Blacklock asking Supreme Court Advisory Committee, SCAC, to study the possibility of a statewide, I don't know if I'd call it a statewide system. It almost seems like it's more of a adjustment to the rule that at least at some level might have been lodged at the Travis and Bexar County systems. Is that a fair statement?
I think so. That was certainly what it said. It said, we're going to explore eliminating central docket systems. And so I think I had no other way to take it as it being aimed Travis County and Bexar. I think in fairness to the Chief Justice and the Supreme Court, the legislature has spent about a decade now doing a bunch of judicial accountability statutes and a large scale reporting requirement now for judges. I mean, when I started this job in 2011, I think we had one collective report. It was a collective report. It basically reported up all your civil cases, all your criminal cases, all your family cases collectively and your clearance rates. We now have something like 16 reports. And in the top six urban counties in Texas, every single judge in those top six urban counties has to do a monthly report on judicial data. Comes through the clerk's office, but it has become a huge part of the job. That was passed two sessions ago. And then this last session, so when they start last session, which is also when this letter comes out, judges are really desperate for a pay raise. And there's a lot of concern about, well, how do we, the Senate Judiciary Committee, they have a lot of meetings about how are we going to find the bad judges? They just do. It's not just one side or the other. They like to meet and they like to talk about how are we going to make sure judges are doing the job that they're doing, that they're supposed to be doing. Because judges want a pay raise, but we don't trust that they're working is basically their position. And in fairness to the Chief Justice, I think he's at one of these committee meetings, committee hearings, and they ask him, maybe the idea bubble goes off in his head about, well, I can help them find judges. It's just Travis and Bexar. They can't find Travis and Bexar because they have this central docket and we can't make sure their data is correct. And so if we get rid of the central docket, we can make sure they too have to report. Because right now we're reporting by court number. And since I don't always hear the court number that I sit in, the data doesn't necessarily track me. It tracks my court number. And all of our court numbers are some of the best in the state in terms of clearance rates. but it doesn't tell you necessarily what Judge Meacham is doing. It tells you what the 201st court is doing. And so I think they were after that. I think it was a lot more difficult than they thought it would be because the underpinning of a shared docket is so strong in the Constitution. And so it just, there was a lot of groundswell of support, I think, for the central docket and the presiding dockets out of our two counties. But I think more than that, it's really a hard thing to change the Constitution, change the statutes, and change 100 years worth of case law with a court rule. And I think that challenge was conveyed to them. And instead, we ended up with something a little different. It's not going to be easy, but it's not precisely doing away with the central docket either. It's a different type of rule is where we ended up.
It almost sounds like this was kind of the perfect storm, as opposed to there being someone with an organized agenda saying, we're going to go in and we're going to target these two counties specifically. Maybe that's what it was. I don't know. But you mentioned, you know, the pay raise. You mentioned Travis County having a super high clearance rate, but yet you can't measure judge by judge basis. It's just interesting to see. And congratulations on getting the pay raise, by the way. But oh, yeah, here's the tether that comes along with it, is you've got to do all this reporting and give us all this data, which is driving everything these days.
Well, the one that I was telling you about, the one that's for the top six counties, that was actually from the 88th session. And I think it's House Bill. I never can remember these off the top of my head, but there's a House Bill. But there was another House, there was a Senate bill that same session that was a whole other reporting requirement. So 88th session, there's two big reports. Then they do this 89th session. We start with kicking it off with, well, the judges really want a pay raise. And what ended up happening is we got it. But it's a 25-page bill called the Judicial Transparency and Accountability Act. And so also in that document, in addition to a nice pay raise, took us from, I think, 49th in the country to 26th in the country. So we didn't like blow the doors off or anything, but it certainly made the judicial pay commensurate with other judges around the country. There are also 24 pages of new reports of new burdens on judges. There's a timekeeping requirement for judges now that goes live in July. Every district court judge in the state now has to keep their time. There is a more teeth are added to the State Commission on Judicial Conduct. And now it's basically completely appointed by the governor, and they don't have to be lawyers anymore on the State Commission on Judicial Conduct. Gave them a lot more ability to remove judges. It's not a complaint-based system anymore. They can do things on their own without getting a complaint. And I think what civil lawyers are starting to figure out is that bill had a real Christmas tree problem, a real ornament on it that I think the lawyers around the state are starting to figure out, which is they had these requirements for the summary judgments, where we basically wholesale changed how every lawyer in the state has to practice summary judgment practice now. And it's really quite been something for something that no one was even paying attention to. I think that people were paying attention to the bail parts of that bill because criminal judges were up in arms and a lot of the criminal justice community was up in arms. Obviously, judges were paying attention to the pay raise. There were parts of that bill that different people were paying attention to. But we end up with this really wholesale change of summary judgment practice that no one really knows where it came from. No one really knows why we did it. And I think people are realizing has a lot of real practicality problems for lawyers across the state.
Yeah, I'll refer our listeners and watchers to episode 160 back in January, where we talked about the new rule before it became final. And then episode 163, where we back in March, where we talked about the final rule and the fact that there's essentially four different sets of rules that apply depending on when the motion was filed and all that sort of thing. It is still quite a morass to try and get through, but I'm not telling you anything, Judge. You're living it right now.
I was going to say, we have talked at length about that, and it really does. And practicality for judges, too, because it puts you on time clocks that while you do have some control over, you don't have complete control over, because it also requires the party's input. And the party who files it sort of controls the clock, but also doesn't.
Well, I'm living it. I'll tell you, the clerks, we are just talking judges and lawyers, but the district clerks around the state are very apoplectic. I can't even give you the right word, but they are very worked up because the reporting is actually on them. They're like the judge's tattletales, but they also have three very hard reporting deadlines in this. They have to both mine the data and get judges the summary judgments that are filed in their particular courts, but then they have to come back in and make sure that the judge and report that the judges heard the summary judgment within the 60 days or the 90 days if they grant that small 30-day extension. And then they have to report again on the judge if they made it through, they did issue their written ruling within the 90 days. And I'll tell you, because you guys are rules geeks, I can tell, they told an entire room full of judges, every judge across the state the other day, that you don't count weekends and holidays. And we all looked at them. So, because we were all looking at, I think it's Texas Rule of Civil Procedure. Is it 4 or 5? That's just basic day counting, right? If it's less than 5 days, you do count weekends. If it's more than 5 days, you don't count weekends and holidays. We all kind of know that. We were working off of a 90-day understanding that it's 90 days as to a calendar. And then they said we had 90 days, not including weekends and holidays. And everybody on that Zoom call were confused. I'll just put it that way. So there's a whole...
I'm confused. What does that even mean?
Yeah, me too. I hadn't even thought about that wrinkle.
Well, we were all like, well, that's fine, I guess. But I don't even know how to count days like you're talking. Like, you know, you skip some holidays are recognized in some counties and not recognized in others. There are natural disaster days. And I would say those are rare, except we've had them so much in Texas, haven't been rare at all. You know, so when you think about it that way, they've gone back to the drawing board and they may redo their CLE presentation for all the judges and all the clerks, because even the way they were counting days is very different. So it's very chaotic. It's chaotic, the Office of Court Administration. It's chaotic with every judge in the state and every court administration in the state. It's chaotic with the clerk's offices, and it's all the way down to the lawyers. But when you change things the way they've changed them, it's a sea change in summary judgment practice. I think it was always going to be chaotic, but I'm curious. And my pitch to the lawyers who watch this is maybe lawyers can do something about it. I think that judges probably can't. As I told you, for the last decade, the legislature has really been after trial judges. We could talk about why. I'll try not to whine. And they want us to do data and data and data. And so they tied summary judgments to judicial data, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I, too, want to try cases with genuine issues of material fact and law. That's my goal. I don't want to go to a jury trial on a legal claim that doesn't exist, because that's wasting my time. It's wasting your time. It's wasting the taxpayer time. But nothing in this statute that they passed, SB 293 or amended in HB 16, looks at substance and purpose at all. It just looks like deadlines and dates. And the deadlines and dates, unfortunately, don't get to the heart of the issue, which is you want to be a lawyer for your client on a particular case. You want to give them advice about when to file summary judgments, what evidence to attach, and how to respond to those summary judgments. And judges want to get there too. At least the vast majority do. I know there's urban legends, and I'm sure some amount of there's veracity to some of this, where there were some judges who weren't giving hearings or weren't ruling. And that's a subject of frustration. But I really think the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of trial judges around the state were actually trying to take their summary judgments seriously, rule on them timely, and get to trial on genuine issues of material fact and law, because that made the most sense for them and the cases in front of them. Because there were two bad judges, we ended up with, and I don't even know if there were, but we ended up with a rule that's very hard for us all to manage. And it's also tied to all this judicial data and judicial accountability and judicial responsibility stuff. It is causing judges, I think rightfully so, to be very worked up. And so you're seeing stressed out judges worried about their own data and their own careers, worried about that State Commission on Judicial Conduct, worried about the responsibility to manage their own dockets. Because in an effort to kind of come after us and go after even the central docket, there's all that's out there now is all about judicial accountability, judicial responsibility, and basically a numbers games on clearance rates and disposition rates. And because of that, judges are right to be worried. They're right to be concerned. So you're facing that, unfortunately, with you and your clients are facing something that I've never seen before. I've never seen judges this worked up collectively about deadlines, really, because we've never had anything really like this before.
Well, and I think the lawyers are worked up at the same time because it totally changes summary judgment practice and kind of imposes deadlines on lawyers that before were a little bit more manageable and managed by things outside of the rules themselves. And I mean, were I a judge and I was worried about disposition and I had a question on summary judgment, I would just deny the summary judgment because of time pressures. And that unfortunately may not always be the right answer, but I think that may happen more frequently, unfortunately, because judicial discipline is now on the line, which seems like an unnecessary hammer in my own personal opinion, but you know.
Yeah. And what's the trickle down effect from that? I think, okay, well, if maybe otherwise meritorious summary judgment motions are getting denied, are we going to see an uptick in mandamuses tied to summary judgments?
I also think what we're going to see are creative ways where good lawyers figure out maybe I can file something that doesn't exist yet, you know, some sort of remittiture, some sort of motion to dismiss that has yet to be discovered in Texas practice. You know, like you're going to find creative lawyers are going to try and find ways around these kind of hard deadlines because they know judges are stressed out about it. I don't know if it's going to work or not. I'm not even encouraging you to do it. I'm just saying I know lawyers and they may come up with new pleadings that we have yet to see to meet the moment. I'll put it that way.
Those discussions I have heard ongoing in the background and, you know, I understand it. I do.
I think there's also worry that a lot of judges, you say deny, I think there's a worry that there's some judges who might grant without opportunity for the respondent to be heard. You know, I think you're right. That gets appealed and the denial doesn't. But you're also then stressed about meeting your disposition rates, right? And so what's happening all across the state, for all the reasons I've been saying, is judges are setting these large drop dockets, DWOP dockets, because again, we're worried about our clearance rates. I mean, we are paranoid and they are coming out to get us, right? It's both. And so one of the things the pressure is, you may not just deny it. You might grant it because when you grant it, you get to dispose of a case. And so both worries on both sides, I think, are real issues. It depends on what you're going to get with each individual judge and maybe each county. But you'll hear bizarre stories now about how some cases are getting set for DWOP dockets within 6 months of getting filed because judges are just trying to meet the demands of judicial data. We haven't done that, but I do know that I totally understand the instinct, which is just, if you're not doing your case, I got to move it. I was speaking recently at the Advanced Medical Torts on this issue out in Santa Fe, and they were worried because on Advanced Medical Torts, in those cases, you don't really, if you're trying a med mal case, even if you're doing a summary judgment in a med mal case, it might take you 2 years. You might really be working hard on that case, and it might be 2 years before you get to a motion for summary judgment. But under this new world where they're reporting your clearance rates, they don't want you to take longer than 18 months on anything. And so the idea that a case is going to take longer than 18 months is antithetical to all this judicial data that's existing in the world. I'm going to push back on that because I've been doing this a long time and I'm going to hold the line. But I'm a little more comfortable as a fifth term judge, about to be a fifth term judge in Travis County, because I just have a little more historical understanding. But if I'm a new judge and I'm just trying to look good and not get an opponent and try to stay out of the paper and try to stay away from the State Commission on Judicial Conduct, I'm feeling the stress and I've got to close my cases. And the only way I can show judicial data is this numbers game about how efficient I am. It's not about substance. No one's checking your substance. They're just checking your numbers. And that's why I call it lies, damn lies, and statistics.
You know, I had a question about, wasn't all that long ago. It kind of seems like it was, but it wasn't. We were all dealing with COVID and the backlog, the litigation backlog that came out of that. Is Travis County or our statewide courts generally, is that still a thing? Are we still in a sort of a backlog trying to clear out older cases that were left over from COVID, or is that mostly gone now?
It's about to get really weird, but here's what I'm going to tell you about data that's really weird, is that all the clerks farm out case management systems to a third-party company. No county is running their data on their own. They couldn't. It's so much, especially in a, think of a large urban county. Think of Harris, right? Like think of how many cases there are. The idea that you're doing this anyway, especially with e-filing, without that you're somehow managing it, it's all farmed out and most of it is under a one company monopoly with a company called Tyler, and they run a case management system called Odyssey. And what we started realizing when we've all had to have, and I'm really deep in the weeds in this as an administrative judge, and I think a lot of other administrative judges are dealing with this too. The truth is, it's really been a battle to just figure out what a lot of our data is, because we don't necessarily have easy access to the cases that are filed in our court and how they are managed by the clerk's office and managed by this third-party vendor. Tyler, maybe we've had to look at things this way. And Travis, we've noticed that there are cases that we definitely closed, that there are dismissals, there are final judgments. And for whatever reason, they're not coding closed because we don't code them closed. We just sign the order. Like we don't actually type in the code and we don't ever go back and check with this third-party vendor on what they're doing on the back end. So I'll tell you, we have a pretty good handle on things in Travis, have a good relationship with my clerk, but I think every judge in the state is really realizing, wait, now that they're looking at my data so hard, now I really have to understand who's got my data and how can I get to my data and how can I start making sure it's correct? Because I started noticing right away that there were just cases that definitely have final judgments, that definitely have dismissals, and they're still being reported up as open. And I'd never had to stress about that, right? Like it wasn't like I was sitting around, I was just signing my orders and lawyers were going away because they thought it was closed too. But now we have this hanging chad issue of another 2-3-step process where we're just having to make sure that they're actually closed. And that has been really, frankly, eating my lunch. Like I just can't spend enough time on that issue. Because every time there's always some bizarre side story about, well, when we changed case management systems, this coding problem happened. And when we did this, this problem happened. And so sometimes it's a tech problem. Sometimes it's a personnel problem. But it's really been a real battle that the data is just not right. It's just the data, even what you're seeing isn't actually true. And it's not just a Travis County problem. It's a problem everywhere because we're not like sitting there with our own Excel spreadsheet, Cloden case is closed and those are going up. Once we rule on an order, we're trusting that the process is doing that correctly, but we've had to all realize, and I'll just talk to any judge about this very boring topic. I'm sorry. People are turning off now, but this very boring topic of does a case get closed when you've signed a final order? And the problem is sometimes it doesn't.
Well, I hear the reference. I think I've seen the clearance rate in Travis County is like 108%. And so, you know, if you're clearing more cases than you're bringing in, to me, that just kind of suggested that maybe there still was a little hangover from COVID. I hate to dredge up that old topic.
I think that's a snapshot. That was a snapshot because we have some months where we do code it that much. And then we have some where we're more like 80%. What happens also, again, I'm getting real boring, but I'll just give you a basic court administration.
Not for us. We are rules nerds, as you said, yes.
And then in July, August, and September, every year in all the big counties, everywhere really, what starts getting filed are ad valorem tax cases. You might have filed one yourself, right? But most of them are big commercial ad valorem tax cases. They get their change in their tax, they protest it. It's a tax protest ad valorem tax case. They sue the Central Appraisal District. For just concept, in Travis County, we get about 2,000 to 3,000 of those a year in that time frame. So it's really hard to have a good clearance rate in July, August, and September because those cases flood the system. So we might have clearance rates in those months as low as 80%, but we try to make it up for it later with a higher number. You kind of learn these things. I've had to learn them all myself as we've gotten deep into court administration and judicial data. It just depends. I think that may be a 1 month snapshot, Todd. And sometimes we have that high. We try and stay around 90%. You try and stay around 90%. The truth is, a real backlog, I think we don't have. A data backlog, we definitely have, right? No one was saying in Travis, you couldn't get a hearing or this case can't get set such that people were waiting in the queue. But we did notice whether they're aberrations of cases not getting closed that were closed or just whatever reasons cases disappeared in the ether, that there were some hanging open cases out there that we got to get to closing. And we have more of those maybe than other places.
As much as I love statistics, I'd like to talk about some of the practical effects of this rule. And that's all really helpful background to hear, Judge. And I appreciate you bringing all of that to our attention. You know, we've sat around and pontificated about what the new summary judgment rule means for practitioners. And we've only been able to speculate what it means for judges. And you've helped shed some light on that. I know you've thought about this and even spoken about it. So do you have a roadmap or maybe some tips for practitioners who are, you know, are crossing this rule for the first time since it's come into effect and maybe ways that they should go about handling summary judgments that they didn't have to think about before?
I also want to hear a lot of feedback from y'all on this because I'm trying to get from lawyers honest feedback as well. I think there's very little we can do to help you really, but I want to try and help you where possible, especially the good lawyers who really are paying attention and really are trying to follow the rule. So let me know. But I think my big thing for people is what had always happened in previous times that I think just needs to go away is the summary judgment that's filed as sort of a mediation tactic or a settlement kind of strong arm, right? Or even a want to see the other side's evidence. I think even that's hard. I think you should really only be filing a summary judgment if it's ready for a hearing and you really mean it. And it's weird that to have to say that because I was a practicing lawyer. I filed a lot of summary judgments. I worked with one lawyer who loves to file them. It was just his rule. He was like, this is when we're going to file it. Every case had a summary judgment because that was how he practiced law. I just think that's hard now. Like if you file a summary judgment, a judge has to rule on it. And it should be ripe. It should be ready. It should be one that you think is worth a judge's time. And when you file it, you should set it as contemporaneously as you can with that judge or court administration or whatever it is. Because what we're also finding is they would get filed and we've had to mine the data, right? Clerks have to go in now every week and pull out the filed summary judgments of the week. And about half of them haven't asked for settings. They just there. And so we're then having to set them. And I don't know how it works in Fort Worth. We'll talk about that a little bit in other places. Like, do judges set? Do clerks set? Do court coordinators set? Or do lawyers set, right? Like, it's a series of different ways that courts do it around the state. But the idea that we're going to leave it out there and get to it later, I don't think we can do that. I think we have to know what our setting is going to be when we file the motion. Because if not, chaos is going to start ensuing. Or no, you're going to ask for it to be heard by submission, whatever that's going to be. I'll tell you, the one thing the judge has is I think the judge can still determine if they're going to hear it orally or if they're going to hear it by submission. So you also are going to want to know what your particular judge wants in the jurisdiction that you're filing it in. In Travis County, we're mostly still going to hold to hearings. We still want to have an oral hearing, but there could be judges around the state who are really going to just move to a complete submission practice. And that's the one thing that the judges do have the power to do under the new law and rule. It's completely our call, I think, if we hear it by submission or if we hear it by oral hearing.
Yeah, this whole thing about withdrawing a motion to avoid the mandatory ruling timeline is something we've talked about. And I'm curious about, is that going to become a thing? And then how does the trial judge, I'm not asking you to speculate as of today, but how would the trial judge view the lawyer who continuously files and withdraws and files and withdraws? It just doesn't seem like that would go over well to me.
I just was talking before this started with Judge Maya Guerra Gamble about that very issue and how that was driving her a little bit mad and how she was sort of regretting explaining the rule to the lawyer because now she's at the third time where the clerk has had to tell her there's a motion for summary judgment. You know, like we're reaching the point of absurdity kind of where they would file a notice of withdrawal and that very same day filed an amended motion for summary judgment. And you know, that just means like we're having to take time out of our day and deal with it again, right? So
I guess that restarts the clock, right?
It does. It restarts it immediately.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to go well, I think. Don't do that. I would recommend not doing that. I don't know that, you know, I don't want to say substantively, I don't know. You know, in an urban county, as much as it's going to be difficult for us, we're pretty set up well with our master calendar system to actually hear summary judgments under the confines of the statute. And by that mean, basically, you file a summary judgment in Travis County, you're going to have a date that is after the 35th day and before the 60th day. That is a date that exists on our court calendar. You can find it, you can set it, you don't have to make sure the judge is available. You can do that. And that's what the law requires. But there are judges all across the state. And frankly, the more rural you get, right, they may sit on four different counties on a circuit. They may be in the middle of a felony case. They may not come back to that county to hear it in for a while. So there's not even a date available for them to even take up that motion by oral hearing. So they're only going to be able to hear it by submission. That's the only thing that's possible. And they're going to have to stop everything else they're doing and consider it on a date, make a physical docket entry about it, because that's also required by us under the rule, and then make a note to yourself that you have to rule on it within 90 days of that. So the weird little chutes and ladders of the rule and the kind of trap doors for judges are pretty extensive. It's not going to help the trial lawyer's case if they're making that more difficult, especially in Travis, where, quite honestly, you can set your motion. There is a date that exists on our calendar, no matter when your motion is filed, within that 25-day period. And if you really need the extra 30 days, we definitely have that, right? So you just need to know when your motion needs to be set. You need to have that date in mind, and you need to file your motion and set it right away, if that makes sense. And I think Travis, that's the answer. Other places, maybe you can tell us, Jody, I mean, I'm curious how it's working, you think, in an individualized docket in Tarrant, for example.
I think it's just going to depend on the court. And that's part of the issue is some courts have a lot more readily available hearing dates than others do. You know, I was telling Todd before we got on the call, this is not a summary judgment, but in a general jurisdiction court in a different county, someone had asked for hearing dates. It's April 15th when we're recording this, and the earliest hearing date they had was mid-June, early to mid-June. I don't know what you do with that. And that sort of makes the decision sometimes on the submission versus oral hearing for you right there, because there really is nothing you can do about it if the court doesn't have options. Appellate filing requires precision. A small mistake could derail your case. That's why you need Counsel Press, trusted by 100% of the Am Law 100 firms since 1938. Whether it's e-brief preparation, indexing, or electronic filing, they provide complete support, ensuring every document meets the highest standards of accuracy and compliance. Their dedicated team of appellate counsel and paralegal specialists guide your case through every step. From review to filing, Counsel Press has your back. Visit counselpress.com to learn how they can support your next appeal.
I was curious, Judge, I think you were talking about this in the context of judges riding the circuit, but, you know, as opposed to choosing strictly between either an in-person hearing or ruling on submission, would that not be a good opportunity to use Zoom for a summary judgment hearing?
I'm fine with Zoom, but I mean, you know, you've met trial judges. There's many of them who really don't like it. Like, you know, like they're not going to do Zoom. They did all the Zoom they would ever do and probably 100% more than that during COVID. And they are happy to never, ever, ever know what Zoom is ever again. So, and I think it's the one, like I said, it's the one thing that this rule still allows a judge to decide within the confines of the deadlines is the format they want to use for consideration of the summary judgment. So if I wanted to set it by Zoom, I could. You're right. It's not that hard. It's a summary judgment, right? You shouldn't get evidence in any case. And so that's easy. If I want to set it by submission, I can. That's what federal judges do. And if I want to set it by oral hearing, I can do that. And I think it's the one thing that's left for our discretion.
I don't think there's a lot of motivation for a state trial judge to set a summary judgment hearing over Zoom, though, because you still have to do it from the courthouse, right? So it's not like you can, you know, do that from your vacation home in Telluride or something like that. I was thinking particularly about former Judge Roy Ferguson comes to mind because he was hearing cases in these vast counties and had to even change a time zone to go from one county to another in one instance. So that seems like that's maybe in those instances a good example of a good use case for Zoom. But I totally understand if a Travis County or any other county judge doesn't want to offer Zoom hearings if it doesn't really meet their need.
I mean, we tend to, you know, the Travis County rule is basically if both sides agree, you can just set it on Zoom on your own. Before I was doing this with y'all today, I had 3 hearings by Zoom and they were just set because the parties agreed to have them by Zoom. We're pretty open to it, but I do know a lot of judges who really feel strongly. I mean, even some of my fellow judges don't love it. Here's the thing. I think Zoom works fine for certain types of hearings. It's not ideal for others. Some people just like the in-person experience. I don't really know that you gain or lose a whole lot, if I'm being honest, but it's just maybe better lifestyle choice.
No, I think that makes sense. We've kind of talked about Travis County and summary judgments. Has Travis County decided what it's going to do post this new rule and how they're going to transition away from central docket, what that's going to look like?
So we're going to pilot program for the summary judgments, and it kind of is playing out and how we're going to do all this because they're all coming together at the same time. So again, I don't think, and I've heard Justice Lehrman speak on this recently too, they did not eliminate centralized docketing systems. What they did was they put a new rule in place under Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 330E and the Rules of Judicial Administration that said judges will be responsible for their dockets. So that's why I'm saying it's more tied to accountability now. We're working on our rules under the government code. The local administrative judge is also responsible for the local rules, which is another great thing and why no one really wants this job. It's terrible. And so we're working on that. It's a lot of work. I mean, I think what happens now is people come to me and request kind of that all their settings that they get assigned to one judge, right? It doesn't matter what court number it's filed in. You got to ask the local administrative judge to basically be responsible for one judge setting. And then I assign it out to a judge. What the big change is going to be, and we're already doing it, I'll just tell you, it's not a secret. It's not a state secret. If you have a pending case in Travis County, you've already experienced this. The individual court judge is deciding that, right? So rather than asking Judge Meacham whether a case that's filed in the 459 or the 200 can have a special setting, you're just going to ask that judge. And you're going to ask that judge if they want to keep that case for all things going forward or if they don't. We're in a transition time because we can still share benches and we're all going to be responsible for our own cases. We know that. But to an extent, we're still going to keep a hub system because we think it works for us and we like it. But we're going to maintain the responsibility of our cases. And so if you wanted a special setting and you thought your case was high conflict or you thought your case was complex, you'll need to go directly to that judge. Since we're in a transitional time, you're still coming to me because that's what the local rules still say. But in my letters, when I'm assigning them, I'm basically just saying, you asked for one judge, that case is filed in the 459th, and you're going to get that 459th judge. We're also doing a lot more transfers. You're going to see that the entire time I've been here, we've not once done an intra-Travis County civil case transfer. Because when you have a centralized docketing system, why would you, right? But now we're going to have to do a lot more transfers. Of course, as I was just telling you earlier, that involves the clerk's office. It involves a third-party vendor. It involves several humans. And so I'm sure a lot of mistakes are going to get made because it's a lot of additional work. But we've already gone through that process. I think for anybody who's noted, if they had a current setting of like one judge, they're already getting those letters now. And they're saying this case has been transferred to that judge and assigned to that judge. So that's how we're handling it. I mean, there's a lot more to do. That's not the only thing we're going to do. But just so you know, we're all going to run our own dockets. We already did that. We already have hybrid dockets. We already have a submission docket that goes to us directly for a lot of different types of cases. We're just going to basically use that process as a more robust process to keep responsibility of cases. And then we'll still use the central docket, hopefully, for small dollar cases, the general work of the dockets, the family court cases where all the associate judges are. At least that's the plan. And I think based on hearing Justice Lehrman talk recently, I think she thinks that's okay because she's gone about in Travis County circles and talked to a lot of CLEs about how we can still run a central docket. We just all have to be responsible for our own cases. So my hope is that's going to do it because I wasn't given a bunch of FTEs, employees to make it work. And I wasn't given a lot of money to make all the changes. So I'm trying to make kind of the simplest changes and hope that's enough. We've hired a lawyer to help us. We have Steve McConico and Kenan Wooten, who are helping us work with our local rules and try to make those better and to give us an extension of time to draft them because we've got to redraft everything to make it work under their new rules of judicial administration. I hope that makes sense. If you have questions about it, I'm happy to answer those.
So there is the mechanism in the order that provides for an extension of time. So Travis County is already planning to seek one.
We sent, during the comment period already, a letter that told them we're going to seek one. And we're definitely going to seek one officially. Gotten some indication that maybe they're not that inclined to give us one, which is disappointing. I'm going to do my best, but I've got to redraft rules that have basically been in place for 50 years that have been written and agreed to by 100 judges over time. And I'm going to have to do it in 3 months. When the last time it was done, it took about a year and a half. So it could be a challenge. And that's why I'm hoping that these changes that we've already made, Todd, are going to be helpful. And we're going to show them we've already tried our best to kind of make the changes we can make now to be responsible for the cases filed in our court numbers. And I hope that'll buy us some time to try and get all these local rules in place.
The last thing I would just ask about generally is just looking at the text of amended Rule 330. You know, it was reported in the media, oh, the central dockets are doomed everywhere. And I read the text of it and I said, nowhere in this amendment does it say the word central docket. And so I look at it and it's like, well, okay, it looks like it's a significant tweak potentially to how my home county district courts are going to have to handle things. But I don't know. I mean, am I reading that right? It seems like it's much more of an incremental adjustment than just a complete overhaul.
I totally think that's correct. But I have hired a lawyer to help me kind of. So I want to say, I agree with you, right? That's how I read it too. I think it pretty clearly reads that way. But then I got in the same reaction you had when I read a couple news articles and I was like, that's not really what it says. And so I've seen Justice Learman actually speak on this topic and she's answered questions that that's not what it does either. And so I think we all understand on the sitting judges here, it's voluntary. We were already kind of dealing with that, right? One judge wanted out and we said, go ahead, leave. They took the other tactic in Bexar County when a couple judges wanted out and they said they couldn't leave. This rule definitely then makes clear that participation in any sort of centralized docketing system is voluntary. 100% it says that. So any judge who doesn't want to be part of it doesn't have to be. I already thought that was the rule, which is why in Travis County, when one judge wanted out, we were like, okay. So I felt pretty strongly that that already existed, but it now definitely exists. Beyond that, like I said, we're making these tweaks that are each individual judge is going to decide whether a case is complex or high conflict and whether they assign it to themselves for all matters in the case or whether they allow the court administrator and his staff to assign it on more of a master calendar system. I think we all understand that we're all going to have to be with our summary judgments. You know, we're going to have to manage our own summary judgments. We don't have to hear them all, but we have to manage them all. And by that, I mean, I am looking at every 201st summary judgment that is filed. Every single one. And I am deciding whether I hear it by submission, whether I hear it, or whether I set it on the master calendar. And then a judge is kind of going from there if I set it on the master calendar. But I get this. We're capable of doing it. It's a lot of work. I'm not going to lie. Like, it's a lot of work, but it's all a lot of work. And we're really committed in Travis County to access to justice. You know, Laura Livingston, who came before me, and John Dietz and Jean Muir and all the judges who've sat with us, they were really dedicated to the idea of this isn't a court system for the rich and the fancy. It's not just for the tall building lawyers, though it's also for them. It's for everybody who needs a hearing and everybody who needs their dispute heard and justice administered. And we really believe that the central docket is really, it almost democratizes courts and makes them more open for everybody. And we really want to keep to that idea because even in this time of great judicial stress and pressure, we really still want to remember the mission. And the mission is access to justice and fair and just courts. And we want to keep that up. And we work well together. We collaborate well. And the judges in Travis County want to keep going forward like we have been to the best that we can. Continue to keep that mission in mind.
So glad y'all are doing that. And thanks for all of this. This has been super interesting. And I think kind of a helpful practice tip for people who practice in central docket counties and not, frankly. As we wrap up, it's kind of our tradition to ask for a tip or a war story. I don't know if you have one in mind that you want to share in our kind of closing minutes here.
I mean, my practice tip in Travis County and really all across the state is, and again, what I said is true. I think that we really are dedicated to trying to keep our courts as open as they can. But I want to say to the lawyers that you're listening, because this is my chance, we're asking for your help. I mean, I really do think that judges in this moment aren't particularly persuasive with the legislature, but I do think it's possible that lawyers could be. A lot of the key members of the House and a lot of the key members of the Senate are your brothers and sisters in the bar. And I really think that they might be persuaded that this summary judgment rule and that some of these continuance rules, some of these kind of imposed deadlines aren't helping lawyers and their clients get just outcomes. And so if you could take that message back to your bar organizations and just say, maybe we need to explain, don't help judges, but help us. Help us be better lawyers for our clients and help us give them good advice and get them outcomes and hearings that they need to have, because we don't want courts that are just about data. We want courts that are about justice. And some of these rules really haven't allowed us to do that recently.
That's a really good one. Judge Meacham, we're so thankful for you joining us today, taking time out of your afternoon. And I know this is going to be an interesting episode for not just the appellate geeks like us, but folks that practice in our county and really need to know, you know, what's up.
All right. Thank y'all so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your colleagues and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. To connect with us, suggest a topic, or inquire about being a guest, visit texapplawpod.com or find us on LinkedIn and X at texapplawpod. Produced and powered by LawPods. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.